Enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska Seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com. I'm HRN's Communication Director, Kat Johnson, with a preview of the next episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. We're exploring the future of eating animals, and we're going beyond typical meat sources.
If you look at the length of human history, we've been eating insects a lot longer than we haven't been in the United States and Western Europe.
We're looking at unusual ways to purchase meat.
People are like, really? Why would I want to buy that out of a machine?
And we introduce you to Frank Rees, a poultry farmer whose traditional farming methods are featured in a new documentary.
I'm a fourth generation farmer in Kansas, and I focus basically all on standard bred poultry and have my whole life.
He's kind of the last one standing with these rarefied breeds that are so important for if we're going to eat chicken and turkey into the future. He's essential. He's a national treasure.
Listen to Meat and Three this week to better understand the history and the future of meat. Available on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The noise they make, but let me introduce my new Rocket 88. Yes, it's great.
All right, we're back. It's June 28th. You're listening to the Main Course OG. Thank you, crowd. I am one of your hosts, Patrick Martins. You just heard Rocket 88 credited as the first rock and roll song ever recorded. I actually learned that in Memphis when I was at Sun Studios. We have some Memphis people here. It was the first rock and roll song. We are the first radio show ever to air. In fact, that song was the first sound ever to come out of these studios. So back in 2009 when we started Heritage Radio. So we got a great show today. We have so many guests here. The body temperature is like, it's like 98.8 degrees in here because so many people. We have my co-host, as always, Elizabeth Greeley. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello.
We have Emily Pearson. Hello, Emily.
Good morning.
We also have Mike Edison.
Ready to roll.
Ready to roll. Our top radio professional in here. I'm Patrick Martins, and we have Brandon Hoy is just back from L.A., where I think Roberta's is opening another restaurant, so he might jump in studio when he gets in the cab. But we have a lot of special guests. We have the Newman family, David, Rita, and Kristen, owners of Newman Berkshire Farm.
Hello.
Good morning, everyone.
So nice to have you guys. And Sarah Wiener, someone who I am a mentor for. No, just kidding. But I am a Slow Food alum, as she is, the true Slow Food alum, like honestly working hand in hand with Carlos. She's the founder of the Good Food Awards.
Hi there.
Both of our guests have events happening here in New York City this weekend. Tonight at Untitled Restaurant at the Whitney Museum, they're doing a big dinner for David Newman. And Good Food Mercantile is this Friday, and tickets are still available. So how do you get tickets?
GoodFoodFDN/Mercantile.
Good. This is the most important congregation of artisan producers in America each year, and it happens in San Francisco. It happens in places like Portland. It happens in Washington, D.C., and this Friday it's happening in New York. It's great. You bring the whole family. They can taste. They can meet the producers who are there, you know, cutting up their wares and serving it. So without further ado, I'll throw it to our charismatic point guard, Libby Greeley.
Thank you, Patrick. So as Patrick said, we're excited to have all the guests in studio today. It is a full house in the shipping container. And we have some great topics ranging from McDonald's, the Humane Society, to Meghan Markle and royal etiquette, then the Maillard reaction. And as always, we end with our weekly grill segment. So let's start with our weekly based. We don't tell our panelists the exact questions and see how they'll perform. So we touched upon this last week, and we had many follow-up questions, so we did some digging. The New York Times now sells food kits delivered to your door. They work through Cheft. They advertise these in full-page ads in their food section. So we had a lot of follow-up questions on this. Is this a conflict of interest? What standards do they uphold in the products they sell? Should a newspaper be selling food? And most importantly, they don't mention where their food comes, their meat comes from.
All right. Well, this is a hot topic for me. You probably would have guessed. But, you know, David Chang has a meal delivery service. I think one of them went out of business. And then Heritage Foods is struggling to sell foods. Now, here the New York Times is selling meal kits. They're in the business of selling something that they're technically supposed to write about, you know, and cover in a, you know, an equitable manner. And I just wonder, you know, is there a conflict there? And then the other thing is it the most humane food in the world? Because if it's just meats from, you know, U.S. foods or just vegetables that they don't really list the source of, like, what standard are they maintaining? And do they do this for other things like arts and crafts and, you know, does it affect, do they not write about us so they could sell their own meal kits? I mean, that's what the big question is.
Here's your kit, how to run for a Supreme Court nomination.
Do you think, am I on the short list?
You know, I did a deep dive into the Chef website, mm-hmm. and looked at what they were selling, and you're absolutely correct. They did not tell you the source of their food. They're glazed salmon, it's $33 for two portions, does not tell you where the salmon comes from.
Is it wild Alaskan salmon?
No,
that's
idea.
The standard.
It says salmon fillet, that's all it says. Their herb steak, a boneless New York strip steak, and all it does is come with steaks. I mean, there's nothing in it that makes it really a kit. There's no trick. It's not like buying one of those models that you could build into a Frankenstein or a jet fighter when you're a kid, you know, where you had no choice. This is just two steaks, mm-hmm. okay? So you have to be kind of subnormal to get it anyway, but it doesn't tell you where the steaks come from. You're absolutely right.
Is it grass-fed? Is it
heritage? Doesn't say,
because you know,
anything is sourced. But here's something else you should know: Chef partners with a lot of people. It's not just the New York Times, and they have the same sort of deal. And some of their partners that they sell these food kits for include Campbell Soups, Florida Orange Juice, Glad. That's the company that makes plastic bags. So I don't know. You know, you really want to buy a food kit from a place that's their main product is like modern petrol technology and a, you know, and a snappy closure. They work with Coca-Cola and Men's Health magazine and a few other periodicals as well. They're all over the place. They do not that discerning.
Do I get the same price for a full page ad for Heritage Foods in the New York Times food section as they do? I wonder, Sarah.
Well, I think food kits will be gone in 5 years. Didn't Blue Apron have like the worst IPO of 2017?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Like they're not profitable. That's what maybe why they have to obfuscate where they're sourcing from, because they're not sourcing good ingredients. And I've never had a super delicious experience with them, mm-hmm. I must say.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, how are you going to get two steaks for $32? I mean, honestly, even if you went to a responsible butcher, how are you going to buy the ingredients, never mind the convenience of this food kit? The ingredients cost more than that, even, you know, at the street price, at a fair street price from a responsible place. So obviously, this is not the good stuff.
And do their writers, and I don't think they do, to be honest with you, but do their writers not write about certain topics knowing that the Times is in the business of selling stuff? It's the question that they are going to be forced to be asked, even though it might be one where they're like, absolutely not, I do whatever I want. But it doesn't seem right as a food guy.
It's definitely a hot topic for us. That's why we came back to it this week. Our next, Otter Pops. Just launched a new line of 100% coconut water sorbet ice pops infused with a splash of gender equality. Yes, you heard that right. They popped their heads into a cultural movement we care about by working with Academy Award winner Gina Davis and her Institute on Gender in Media to gender balance their Otter characters, because they are committed to inspiring both girls and boys. Male characters for major brands outnumber female characters 2-1. You have two kids, Patrick, mm-hmm. a girl and boy.
A boy,
how do you
50-50. See, I'm 50-50.
Yeah, exactly.
Me too.
You too?
You have two kids as well.
See, we're progressive.
How do you feel about Otter Pops?
And we put a little soul into every pig we produce too, so why not?
Otter Pops. It makes zero sense.
I don't get it.
Wait. Are you what makes zero sense?
It makes zero sense because honestly, I want my coconut water sorbet to be like gender neutral. I don't a splash of gender equality.
No, these
first
are...
of all, I'll take my gender equality straight up. Okay, neat in a glass. This makes no sense. Okay, I get it. They're promoting. I get it. Girl power. I'm all for it.
No, these
all
are
for
like
better
pops.
No,
representation.
It's not about girl power. Yeah. The whole idea is that it's gender neutral. It's supposed to be saying that you're not choosing it because it's a, you know, female character on the box or a male character.
Well, she's trying to
cool.
level the playing field from what I'm reading here, because that male characters are major brands, and I assume they mean like Tony the Tiger, that stupid
or the little
pecan,
leprechaun, the Lucky
you know,
Charm leprechaun
or whatever are
it could
dudes.
Be gender neutral. I think the leprechaun could
be gender neutral. But an ice pop doesn't have gender.
Well, some of them have faces
Although they are shaped like penises.
Yeah, yeah. But they are, you know, there is a lot of issue here. I mean, yeah, if females are never portrayed in the shape of the popsicle or whatever, yeah, that's a little unfair. Sarah, what do you think?
I mean, I think anything that promotes gender equality, great.
Yeah.
What's the harm?
What's the harm?
Yeah. And yeah, otters are cute.
Otters are cute.
Exactly.
They are.
The New York Post reports legal pot will come to New York. Cannabis industry experts predict, noting the economic benefits to states and cities. Indeed, it is inevitable, they add, because as neighboring states approved such legislation, it will come here as well. We know this is a hot topic for Mike. As always,
why am I always
High Times?
Well, you know, I wear that High Times gig around my neck like an albatross. Have you walked around Brooklyn lately? I mean, the whole borough smells like weed, especially by Patrick's house.
But Emily actually says she thinks everybody's getting stoned just like at the subway with these new vapes. She's like, I just saw 50 people get stoned on my way to work today.
No, I think it's just that it's subtle. There's now formats in which to be high all the time, whether people know it or not, because it's not like you're, you know, lighting up a bowl or walking around with a bong. Like, it's this little teeny pen. It's all that subtlety.
So, lighting up a bowl, that drug slang.
Sorry.
Okay, you're obviously pegged as a user now. No, you know, there's just...
Or I know nothing about it.
You know, those are the pens, the vaporizers. I think people assume that they don't smell like marijuana, that it's like this clear-smelling vape, which is not true. It smells like weed. And listen, I'm very pro-pot and very pro-legalization. I think the concept of arresting someone for getting high is absolutely absurd. I think the war on drugs, not just pot, is a war against people. And obviously the drugs won. Okay. That being said, you have a reasonable expectation not to have the subway station smell like weed. And I think that's fair. I don't want to get on the F train and have to smell like a Jethro Tull concert.
Can I ask a question, honestly, amongst us liberal people here? What bad things will come if pot is legal? Or if in Myrtle, Missouri, people are just able to go down the street and smoke pot? Is there a bad thing that comes from us? I mean, we basically debunked the fact that it's a gateway drug last week. I mean, basically, it doesn't lead to cocaine, for instance, in our opinions. But are there anything bad that comes? Smelling subways, that's one.
Well, but there's a downside to being stoned, not being clear-headed. By the way, this law doesn't cover smoking pot in public, which is still illegal, but part of the idea is they're no longer going to be arresting people for it. They're supposed to be giving people tickets for it, you know, basically the equivalent of a parking ticket. But that's been the policy in New York City for a very, very long time. Where you get into trouble is the kids that were being arrested were largely... in underprivileged neighborhoods, there were young men of color, and they're being run through the system because they were told to empty their pockets, and they had a joint in their pockets. Now they had marijuana in public, and now they were arrested. Because having it on your person, a misdemeanor amount, it shouldn't arise to anything. I mean, drug busts are predominantly for young men of color. That's the problem here. And also, and we'll get to this, I see there's a little note here about good manners. It's not good manners to smoke pot in public in some places. You know, listen, there's a time and a place for everything.
I like these cannabis industry experts. Who are these people?
Well, me, apparently.
and they're the one predicting this, so.
Sarah, do you have anything to say?
Yeah, I just got to say, less customers for the prison industrial complex. Good.
That could be good, yeah.
But, yeah.
When are we bringing food to weed to the Good Food Awards?
Well, you're not the first one to suggest that. And maybe one day, though, that would be kind of hard to judge.
You have told me that snacks are a new category. Are people going to try to have that incorporate some?
No, but snacks might benefit if cannabis becomes legal. Maybe. But I do think eventually there will be a wine spectator for pot. Like once it becomes legal and every terroir you can just go and visit and someone's like, I have the best pot all the time. And it'll be interesting if Good Food Award tackles that in a few years.
Mm-hmm. Well, that does exist to some degree. There's Leafly.com and High Times has been doing their Cannabis Cup. But there are a million spinoffs of that sort of award where they do award the best pot on a bunch of categories. And the problem with pot is, you know, once you smoke two joints, I mean, the third is kind of moot. It's not like wine tasting where you could spit and it pairs with something because marijuana really isn't gastronomy. I mean, let's be honest about this. This is a stalking horse. I mean, it's wonderful that this weed has notes of blueberries and citrus and all the stuff, but you're also judging it based on its ability to, you know, to get you high, and it's going to get you really, you know, like let's get naked and get out the finger paints high, or it's going to get you let's sit on the couch and watch Bugs Bunny high. It doesn't play by the same rules as wine and food.
Have you started finger painting, by the way? We asked
no,
this last
I still
week.
Haven't. I haven't gotten around to it yet.
Edibles are becoming a huge thing in San Francisco. In fact, it was like the cover of the Edible San Francisco this month.
Really?
Was edibles.
Your eyes are so dilated right now, I can't even focus on what you're saying.
Thanks, Patrick.
Hey, watch out. He once gave me a pot cookie and didn't tell me until you know, until the room started spinning.
By the way, the problem with that was not that I did that, is that his show that day had 10 kittens in the studio, which was a HACCP plan violation.
Every possible health violation. We were doing a show
that
adopting
was his
kittens,
problem.
And I didn't realize that the crazy cat ladies were actually bringing the kittens with them.
Don't look at me for that one.
So this next topic, I think the Newmans will probably have a lot to say about it. The Humane Society of the United States says it's launching a new TV ad campaign aimed at getting McDonald's to improve its welfare standards for the broilers that are raised and processed for the restaurant chain's various chicken menu items. The 30-second ad depicts chickens genetically selected to grow too large and too fast, experiencing abuse and suffering on factory farms. It will reportedly air in the Chicago market, which is McDonald's home base. Officials said the goal of the campaign is to compel McDonald's to join its peers, including Burger King, Subway, and Jack in the Box, in adopting meaningful reforms for these animals. The activist group said McDonald's had fallen short in only saying that it will study the issue of how broilers are grown. So how do you feel about this as a farmer yourself, David?
Well, that's a million-dollar question, but, I mean, meaningful reform, a focus on welfare is critical, right? I think that's very important, but I also want people who know a lot about animal welfare making those decisions. True. And to me, some of the groups that are pushing that are not experts in animals. And so, you know, I might take a different spin on that than most people would suggest. But, you know, as an animal scientist and a farmer, I want people who know something about animal science and farming helping make the decision on welfare, you know, and not just focusing on the fact that it needs to start at food service and work its way back, even though that has been somewhat successful. So
I have to say, you're exactly right, David. It's so perfect. And Vitor, by the way, I forgot to say earlier, we're engineered by Vitor. Go Brazil, 2-0, round of 16. Mexico is next. Very excited. But this is it. Vitor, if you had to flag one thing, and we learned this through Frank Reese, slower growth for very commodity, fast-growing genetics is cruel. You don't want to prolong their lives. They're so genetically grown to grow fast, and their cardiovascular, their skeletal, their respiratory systems cannot keep up with that fast growth. To prolong that life is not good. So slow growth sounds good, but slow growth makes sense with sound genetics. With their genetics, it's the opposite. And it reminded me of this thing in the U.S., just as you said, people were fighting against eating horses and killing horses in the United States. It's led to huge suffering for horses as a result. It's people with their heart in the right direction, they're not experts, and it has the exact opposite effect.
Do you feel like this campaign, though, at least is focusing on genetics? Like, it was touched upon, but do you think... You know, do you think that's moving in the right direction?
Talk about genetics a bit.
Well, you want my honest opinion?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I don't want the HSUS making decisions about the way I raise animals, period. Mm-hmm. And that's just a fact, because most of the money that's raised there is not going towards animals. It's going towards lobbying, which is kind of a conundrum, right? Because that's the same thing that they would say about the, you know, commodity livestock business. So it's very ironic, you know, right? Everybody's got a mission. What I think is that if you want to look at the 60,000 foot level, anytime a group, regardless of their affiliation or background, is trying to focus on improving the welfare of animals, that's a good thing, mm-hmm. right? That's a good thing. So, but sometimes the underlying goals or, you know, the tactics that are used are not the best. Now, from a genetic standpoint, you know, there's billions of base pairs in DNA. So the more you know about genetics, the more complicated it becomes. But livestock genetics are, you know, it's up and down. And when you look at commodity production, especially your example was in poultry, I mean, it's pretty radical, the advances that have been made, mm-hmm. and in some cases too radical. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that requires people who can really take a holistic point of view and say, what is really the best for the animal.
Yeah.
Temple Grandin for president. I would trust her. Also, can you question the Humane Society when they're using Jack in the Box as a shining beacon of success?
I was a little concerned when I did say, I was like, Jack in the Box, okay.
They got rid of the clown, right? You no longer have to speak into the clown's mouth.
But, now, can I ask about your standards for the Good Food Awards? I know you have about 8,000 forms. No, just kidding. But a lot of forms that people have to fill out about the provenance of their food, charcuterie especially, you know. Is genetics a question that you ask? Like, does your animals come from sound genetics, or are you just worried about where they're raised? Mm-hmm.
So we don't have genetics currently, though we do review every couple years our standards to make sure they're aligned with advances that are happening across the country. We kind of have a theory that we should look to the experts on the standards that we use. So we reference the animal, you know, humane welfare standards and a couple others and say, we require that you meet or exceed those standards. Because we're not experts, and why should we try to reinvent the wheel?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, just as we move on to our next topic, a very serious topic, I see low-calorie ice cream is our next one. But it is important that all welfare organizations start to include genetics in their protocols. Because a factory farm chicken raised on the prairies of Kansas still grows 300 times faster than he's supposed to, as God intended, as nature intended. So is that really helping?
I think one thing that's important is you pointed out, like, there are groups who focus in on the welfare of animals, you know, and then there's multiples, right? There's Certified Humane, there's AHA. Mm-hmm. The groups that have scientific advisory boards of people who are actually experts in animals are the people you need to trust, right? If you're trusting someone who's only a lobbyist, then you know about how far you can trust them, right?
Wait a second. Why should we trust you? Oh, wait, you're a PhD, right? You have a PhD.
Don't believe me because of that.
No, he does. This is an actual PhD in meat science.
We have to make him a judge, you know?
We do. You got to come out in September.
All right.
So he knows his genetics.
Let's get to something more serious.
Right. We're looking at summer food trends for this year because it's summer finally, and according to Food Business, these are the big trends. Vegan barbecue, low-calorie ice cream, bold snacks, and flavored sparkling water.
Bold snacks?
What is a
really?
Bold snack?
Okay, this not only isn't this big, it's not news. Okay, what's next on the list? Ribs? Hot dogs? Hamburgers?
No, wait, Emily has barbecue. An exception. She likes one of these.
Oh, wait. I kind of like low calorie ice cream. I like Halo Top, which is like they tell you that the entire pint is only 280 calories. If you look in the ingredients, it's probably horrific for you, and definitely not low in fat. It's just low.
Isn't that
calorie.
Just called frozen yogurt?
Yes, but this one comes in the aisle at the supermarket. And you know, when you feel guilty about eating a whole pint of ice cream, now you don't. When you're told it's only 280 calories.
But is it good?
It's good enough. It's good enough.
It's no Ben and Jerry's.
Can you spell aspartame?
But, okay, vegan barbecue. Is anyone going to be cooking that up at home? I feel like that's a lot of work.
I grill vegetables on the grill every summer. I've been grilling vegetables since the summer squash, my favorite. But that's a very normal thing to do, very Italian thing to do. You slice up some vegetables, a little olive oil, a little salt and pepper. I mean, that's okay. That's vegan.
You're very cutting edge.
Before I get around, you know, to like the Flintstone size rack of ribs, you know, from Heritage Food, the one that's going to tip over the grill, you know. But yeah, that's not weird. I mean, everybody eats vegetarian.
What were you going to say, Sarah?
Oh, I was just very excited that there were bold snacks. Because that means that we are on trend with our new Good Food Awards category.
Oh, yeah. What is that category? It's snacks?
Snacks. Granola, crackers, chips, but, you know, all made well with organic stuff.
I mean, bold snacks is obviously things like Doritos have been a trend forever. Top 10 lists are so bothersome to me, with one exception, if they almost never change. If a top 10 list is almost always the same, I have great respect for it. If it's just a new group of top 10 restaurants, I'm like, what are your criteria if nobody who was on last year is on this year? Did they close?
I was just trying to keep us all trendy, okay? Jeez. So this is an interesting one. The Royal Wedding was huge a few months ago.
Sponsored by Heritage Foods.
So Meghan Markle has quickly adapted to royal tradition. She has perfected the royal curtsy. She adopted sheer stockings to her wardrobe and basically has her PhD in the Duchess slant. Oh, I almost said slang. I had read that as slang earlier. I was like, what is the Duchess slang? Okay, that makes more sense. But the newly crowned Duchess had a minor slip-up with royal posture
protocol during Tuesday's party at the Buckingham Palace. So Emily was telling me she was sitting next to the Queen and she crossed her legs.
You make it sound like it was me. No, Meghan Markle, not Emily.
Yeah, oh no, Meghan.
Apparently, the Duchess Rita. Slant is this, you sit, I wish that we were on TV and not radio at the moment, but you sit kind of like with your legs on your left or your right side and you cross your ankles, and it's so that your legs stay together versus having this moment of like lifting your leg to cross one knee over the other.
So and like the way Mike is sitting is not very...
No, you should never have your legs open. Never have your legs open.
I see. Well, I see you learned something. So what's up with this? Is etiquette mean anything anymore? Does it exist anymore?
Is it just the royals following this? Or is there
something? Okay, good manners are what separate us from the animals. Seriously, you know? I mean, and it doesn't matter, you know, if you know which fork to use first. I mean, just serious common courtesy. Patrick, do you know the correct way to go through a revolving door with a woman?
You go first. You go first. The man goes first to push the door.
You know, the woman goes behind. No, well, that's the concept. You go behind the woman so you can push it so she never touches the door.
No, you have to go first and launch
the
it.
The other way. What? She goes in, you launch it from behind.
My mother always told me that...
For you to post, comma, Emily.
Sometimes a guy also has to go in. Do you know when? In a New York City taxi. Because the women don't want to have to slide all the way down. So guys sometimes have to go first.
Or you go around. You know, you open the door for the woman. I thought it was thumbs that separated it.
So apparently we are just animals.
Well, I'm very polite. If people know me, I am extremely by the book etiquette. No, just kidding. But I do... I mean, I wonder. Yes, it's sad when it dies. My mother, her heart crumbles when I don't do certain things, like for Anne or all that. And yet, I mean, does it still exist? I mean, what do you guys think on...
Absolutely.
Especially in the South, right?
Yes.
Well, Kristen?
I think it's so great to teach your kids. Like, it's something to aspire to. It's a set of standards, like, to try to be kind to other people and always say thank you. And we teach our kids to hold doors for other people and helping the elderly. And I think it's just a good character.
It's ironic, right? So I'm going to give you a quick perspective is that, you know, Southern culture is very interesting, right? Like you get the door for ladies, you know what I mean? You do nice things, right? But then gender equality's changed that too. Because now you get the door for someone and they're like, I can get the damn door myself. Think about that. You know, and yeah, someone looks, sometimes people look at you and think you're crazy. So I think good manners still exist and I think they're alive and well and all around the world too. It's you just have people who have no manners and they're animals, right?
That's right. Animals.
Well, I prefer someone with no manners at all who is honest than someone like, I mean, I just heard him on the radio on the way in with Mike today, like Mitch McConnell, who might be very polite and yet is completely mired in shit,
he's
knee deep in shit all the time. Just because he's an angry Republican and they're fighting against all these things, he could be as polite as not. Sometimes it makes me not want to be polite to say I break from your system because there's still bad people who act polite.
Well, civility is a real issue right now. Everyone's talking about that, about Sarah Sanders being, you know, asked to leave that restaurant. But the discourse that we're having in this country right now is not that polite. Let's be honest. And I want to add too that New York is a very polite town. You guys are up in the South. You'll notice this is a very big please and thank you town, because if we didn't say please and thank you, we'd kill each other.
Do you know what I call it in New York? It's civil inattention. You're civil, but you're inattentive because you're attentive to everyone like David is, where he's like driving down the road and stops 60 times. I'm like, hey, John, how's it going? Tell me what's going on. If you did that in New York, you'd never get anywhere. How do your crops look? Yeah, where's my cow?
I was lugging a suitcase. I had to go into the city and both. When a woman stopped to help me carry up the stairs, and then a man just took it from me and was like, here, I got this, and brought it down the stairs. No, he didn't steal it from me. He was like, let me help you.
But he was very nice.
He helped me do it. And I was like, that was so nice of both of them. Because I was like, I could do it, but yeah, thank you. So I appreciated that. All right, and we'll get this last one in real quick. So minimum wage hikes have created hybrid restaurants, a new dining category called Fast Fine. Restaurateurs who say they can no longer find or afford servers are figuring out how to do without them. And so in San Francisco, a city of staggering wealth, you can eat like a gourmand with real stemware and ceramic plates, but first you'll have to get your own silverware. Does this concept work? Do we like it?
Okay. So I'm from San Francisco. I live there now. And if you can pay for really nice food, you should also be willing to pay people living wages so that they can have jobs as well. I think it's crazy.
Pay charge a little more. All these things, the no tipping, the all that stuff, it all comes from the restaurateurs not jacking up the price of their pork chop by 75 cents or a buck. Just charge a buck more. And then, yes, if you go out of business because of that $1, then so be it.
Well, but this article was actually, so this article was in the New York Times, and it was really talking about the cost of housing in San Francisco and in California as an example, and saying that as housing costs go up, there is it's directly proportional to restaurant prices having to increase. And it all has to do with the ability to find labor, perhaps even at a living wage. You know, at what point, like, where's the breaking point from a housing perspective? Because what I guess is happening in San Francisco and everywhere, but really there, is that no one can afford to live close enough to the restaurants where they're working. Hmm.
And it's a huge problem. I mean, like, the wealth inequality in San Francisco and the whole country is just crazy. And I think food really has power to help fix that. But yeah, I mean, I read that the median home price in San Francisco is $1.6 million.
Holy
moly. Oh, $1.6 million hit in April.
You can buy a gigantic farm for $1.6 million. Literally thousands of acres.
How many, what's an acre go for in Missouri?
In our area, you would not believe this, high-priced land is $2,000 an acre.
Wow.
So $1.6 million will buy you a ranch, and a big one. Thousands of acres, literally.
But then I'd be in Missouri.
No, stop.
But listen. That's always the question.
You're outnumbered. David's bigger than
he didn't
you.
Say misery. Listen, you know, he didn't,
I mean,
know
New York
the
City,
joke.
Too, has had this problem for a while. The people that work in the restaurants don't live in Manhattan. They live in the outer boroughs. I mean, honestly, my apartment, if I wanted to swap it one for one, I'd get a gigantic McMansion almost anywhere in the Midwest. I mean, you know, like quadruple, you know, the square footage.
I would still come pick you up
house.
Before radio.
In the morning. I'd still be ready in the morning. Exactly. Good. Right on time.
Yeah, there's definitely trade-offs. All right. Any last comments on this? All right. We have to go to break. Take it away, Vitor. We'll be
about what it takes to swim a coastline longer than the entire eastern seaboard and leap tall waterfalls in a single bound. What does it take to survive 200 feet deep in icy salt water? What would you be made of? Wild Alaska seafood is made of tight muscle mass, long chain omega-3s, and incredible micronutrients. It matters where your food comes from. Experience the flavor of the fittest in every bite and enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. Ask for Alaska on the menu, grocery store, or smart device. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com.
I'm Souther Teague of Amoria Margo and the co-host of The Speakeasy right here on Heritage Radio Network. You know, my favorite thing to do every week is to come here and be on the show. I have lots of jobs. I'm a very busy person. And I do this because I love it. I get to sit down and talk to all my heroes for about an hour every week. It's incredible. And I hope that you enjoy it, making a great effort to share with you. And we'd like you to share back with us. It's our summer fundraiser, and we'd love for you to donate at heritageradionetwork.org/donate. You can click on the beating heart, and you can even choose shows that you'd like to donate to specifically. And you can also choose a recurring monthly gift. And for all that, we'd be greatly appreciative. Thank you so much.
Okay, so we are the main course OG here at on the Heritage Radio Network, and Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn. So we have some great visitors in town today. So for the Maillard reaction, we need to get this out. What is New York City's best? The best bagel in the city and the best pizza, so we can direct them in the right direction to go visit.
A lot of the bagel places have closed, so there's a lot less competition than there used to be. My gut answer for bagel is H&H. The Upper West Side one no longer exists. They do have some cousins or something on the East Side. These days there's high competition, though, for like Black Seed Bagel, Essa Bagel, Russ and Daughters. But I think everybody's making them.
H&H.
H&H.
Best pizza, this is a guy who has the number one restaurant in Brooklyn, top restaurant in Brooklyn, all across all categories. He only makes one thing, pizza, Lucali's. Oh. There's a huge line. No one can get in, but it is the best pizza. But no one can get in. So I would say Roberta's. People can get in here.
Well, yeah, like Yogi Berra said, no one goes there anymore because it's too popular. Now, Lucali's is something, but Roberta's, too, has got to rate high.
Yeah.
Okay, not just because they're our hosts, but Roberta's Pizza is nothing to sneeze at. Emily's right. It's weird. A lot of bagel places have closed. Here's a tip, though, for you, all the out-of-towners, though. There is no such thing as a blueberry bagel. If you see a blueberry bagel, run in the other direction. There's no such thing as a whole wheat bagel. Okay, if you see that, run in the other direction, okay? You don't see salt bagels as much as you used to, but the only acceptable things to put on bagels, right? Emily, correct me if I'm wrong. There you go. Onion, garlic, salt, poppy seeds, sesame, and I will accept the everything bagel. I've come to accept
it. Took a while. Okay?
Any other variation is not a bagel. It's like some Goyish impersonation. Run. Run.
By the way, the best slice, I just mentioned whole pies, is Patsy's on 120th and 1st. That's the original Patsy's. It's just a guy with an oven.
For a slice, I do like Joe's on Carmine, the original location.
The original.
Yeah.
Are you guys writing this down? You have a busy day.
They don't do it. Unless it sells Newman pork, they don't sell it. They have 140 restaurants to go to. They're never going to go to a shitty little size place.
Well, we have time for a little bit of pizza. Marta, Martina.
All right, let's go. Weekly Grill.
All right. So David Newman is the owner of Newman Farm Berkshire Pork, and Sarah is the founder of Good Food Awards. We have some questions for both of you. What is the biggest misconception the public has about farming or artisan food?
Elitist.
Yeah.
Oh, that somehow.
That was
I don't
fast.
Know. I don't
Good
know.
Job,
Maybe
Sarah.
People
that
think farming fast. Is. I don't know. The biggest misconception is there's a lot of misconceptions about how much it really takes to produce your food, like the tremendous amount of time and effort that goes into the thing that keeps you alive, the thing you shove in your mouth for nutrition. It takes a lot.
I wouldn't say that's a misconception. People know farming is very hard work.
Yeah, but everybody, it's ironic, right? When you're a farmer, everybody has an opinion on farming. You hear chefs, you hear food experts, and then you ask them one, I can ask them one question about farming, and they have no idea, and it would be a question that every farmer would know.
Test us. Test us.
Are you ready?
Yes.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I'm probably going to get it wrong.
Okay, so... what does the acronym FG stand for? What does the acronym ADG stand for?
Fucking good?
FG? No. No,
Fully grown.
Nope. ADG, FG, they stand for things like feed to gain ratio, average. How many bushels of corn does a pig eat in its life? How many pounds are in a bushel of corn? And how long does it take it to consume it? And what would that be in pounds?
Oh, man.
All right.
So the number of bushels would be around 16 to 17 bushels of corn. There's 56 pounds in the bushel. It's going to be somewhere between 700 and 900 pounds. And if corn's running anywhere near $4 to $5 a bushel, it's very expensive. And that ebbs and flows. The only thing that changes that price is world demand and rain, period. Right? So it's tough, right?
I thought you were going to ask me the gestation time of the pig, which I do know.
I already gave you that.
Nope.
It's to the hour. No, literally to the day.
To the day.
What is it, David? You say it.
Nope. 3 months, 3 weeks, and 3 days. That's the pregnancy of a pig.
Elegant.
Yeah, very elegant.
Very Meghan Markle.
But all I mean by that is
he can plan his vacations around when pigs are
over. There's so many food experts, right? So it's not even a pet peeve. It's just a misunderstanding, right? I mean, I don't pretend to be a chef because I don't know much about food, right? I'm an overeducated butcher. But a lot of people have a very strong opinion about farming. And I say, if you really want to know a farmer.
Well, let's get into, Sarah, you said elitist. That leads into our next question, which you could answer. How can more expensive food feed the world? I mean, talk about elitist money, you know, all that, access.
So I think the solution for both world peace and health and joy is more people paying more money for good food. And I think, obviously, it's not going to make it possible for everyone to do right away, but I think it's the only way that we can move in the direction of everyone being able to have better food more of the time. And if you think about it, like, wealth disparity is one of the huge problems, because people say like, oh, food's too expensive. But you just heard from David why food is so expensive. Like, actually good food, it takes a lot, a whole lot. And it's like the fundamental building block of our lives and our bodies and our health. So it's exactly the place where we should be putting the fair amount of money. So if those who do have disposable income, let's just say the top 30% of earners, let's just start there. If they would pay a fair price, a price that the people making the food, both, you know, the farmers, the ranchers, like the cheesemakers, could have a fine life, like a living wage sort of life, that would... You're right. I mean, and this is the thing.
So you're not asking for every single American to pay more for food, but if just that top percentage did, it would have a huge trickle down effect.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Start there. Suddenly, people who right now are not earning very much at all, who are working in the food industry, which is the biggest industry in the world. So all these people not being paid quite fairly for their work, they're suddenly going to have more demand for what they're doing in a high quality way. So there will be better jobs in that sector. So suddenly there are more and more people, sort of the trickle down happens in tons of directions, but one of the directions is that more and more people will have more money to be able to join the others who are paying the fair price of food. Also, more people will be interested in the subject and why is food more expensive. Mm-hmm. And those people, often in the top third of earners, are also the top third kind of active and powerful in terms of policy. So if those people are engaged in why does this food cost more than I want, policies could change. That could have a really huge impact in sort of leveling the playing field.
Can I ask you a question? You gave a great quote at your annual speech in San Francisco last year, and we credited you, but we used the quote in one of our emails. It was about like new food is like an $18 billion industry. Do you remember that? Really, it was like the whole crux of your economic argument. What was that? Do you remember?
Ooh, now you're testing me. I used a couple different numbers, but I do know that, you know, like the good food in, you know, the industry.
Yeah, that's it.
The industries we work in are almost $200 billion worth of revenue a year. So that's like the beer, the pickles, the spirits, the charcuterie, the cheese. And that's a bigger industry than the pork industry and the beef industry combined. So if you think if people raise their standards of what they're looking for and how, you know, the wheat was sourced for that beer, and which also kind of means what is that brewer paying the farmers in these huge industries? It's like this ginormous lever towards better food. And it's so ironic that people think of good food, you know, good artisan food as elitist, because the people making it are like not really being remunerated in terms of wealth, whereas the people making really crappy food, those are the only people getting rich in the whole food industry.
I totally agree with you. And I mean, that's it. You know, in the United States, we spend the smallest amount of disposable income versus any other population of humans on the planet on food. Go anywhere else and they spend a much larger portion. I mean, go to India where it's 50 or 60%. Go to China where it's 30 or 40%. Now, average income in China is $3,800 a year. So that's different, right? But people pay more for good food. Right. I mean, there's still wet markets. There's still a primary way of buying food in many countries because people don't own a refrigerator. Right. Or, you know, there's apartments being built in China with no kitchens. So people do want to buy good, fresh, local food. But this has always been my stump, and it will be probably forever. It's one of the biggest misconceptions ever exploited. And I have debated this many times with lots of people is that farmers do feed the world, right? But there is this disbelief, and a lot of people will disagree with me when I say this, but people say that the reason cheap food must exist is because we are feeding the world, and that is not true. The only way people around the world get fed is from people who buy food, period. We are not throwing hams out of the back of C-130s in Africa today, right, where people are dying of starvation. They will continue to die until someone buys food and gives it to the people. Okay, so it's like we have to produce more and more and more cheap food because we're feeding the world. The only people who get food are people who buy food. And so, you know, if you look, I mean, we produce a lot of everything globally. everything. Mm-hmm. So that's not a good excuse to eat poor. Mm-hmm. You know, because we take that, a lot of people say, oh, you just raised this food. You raised this pork that's just unachievable. I go, why? You have an extra ski boat. Mm-hmm. That you paid $900 a month for. You could have eaten our pork chop for a fraction of that. You want to buy cheap so you can have the ski boat. It's a trade-off in America, right? You want to have a third car. You want to drive a Mercedes 7 class. That's, you're choosing how to spend your disposable income. Mm-hmm. It's not because I'm the farmer who produces overpriced food. Mm-hmm. It's because you choose to buy mm-hmm. overpriced items other than the thing that keeps you alive, which is food.
Completely agree with you. And then you throw in the fact that 40% of the food produced in America is wasted, goes to the trash. And people are saying food's too expensive in the grocery store. And it's like, well, if people would value food, and when you pay more for something, often you value it higher, it's more precious to you, then and not let it go bad. Buy the right amount. Even on the same weekly budget, you could be getting so much better quality food and supporting awesome people.
Can I ask an obnoxious question, a truly elitist question? If presented with the best tasting pork chop or with a piece of unbelievable charcuterie that's not the boar's head kind, do Americans have the taste experience and the taste buds, the culture to understand it and distinguish it? I mean, something tells me in Europe, yes, because it's talked about so much. It's in every little place where they get their espresso four times a day. Mm-hmm. Are Americans ready for quality food from a gastronomic standpoint? Of course, ethical, yes, everybody can believe in that. But do people get it taste-wise?
I feel like in the last 20 years, the strides that America has made in terms of taste education are tremendous. I feel that the strides in terms of willingness to pay for quality has not kept pace with the desire to have an understanding of what good food is.
What do you think, Newmans? You live in one of the poorest counties in
state of Missouri. Yeah. I think it is changing. And I think people can always remember, you don't have to be a foodie to ask someone, when was the last great bite they had? A common person knows that, right? But now, I mean, they might say something different. Everybody's going to have a different opinion. But, yeah, I believe it is changing. But it's educating consumers.
I think food has gotten so much better in this country. It's unbelievable. Like, in the last 20 years, are you kidding? Everywhere you go, there are vegetarian options. The food is fresher. I mean, salad isn't a dirty word anymore. I know there's still a lot of mass-produced commodity beef and pork that's just horrible. You know, I know that. But by and large, I think people are... open-minded to it. And I think the answer to your question, Patrick, yes, people remember a good meal. People remember, holy shit, that pork chop was amazing, or that pizza at Lucali was amazing. I want to go back. People remember that.
Guys, I'm hungry, so where can we eat some of this stuff? Tonight?
Tonight.
Tomorrow?
And let's plug your events. We have about 2 minutes left, so you each get a minute. You plug your business. Let's start with Good Food Awards. $30 tickets, right?
$35, but important to note, it's just for retailers like grocery store buyers and media. It's actually a trade show. But we do have a big public event that will be amazing in January in San Francisco to recognize all the Good Food Award winners. But if you are a retailer, come. It means there's not a lot of crowds. You really get to talk to the producer. You really get to create that like virtuous business cycle, which is so critical to the food crafters being able to thrive.
What is Good Food Awards? Give me in under 30 seconds what it is.
It's the best tasting food in all 50 states, but all of that incredibly tasty food happens to be made with sustainability and social responsibility rolled into it.
So it's a competition, but it's also trying to change the marketplace by getting retailers to commit to purchasing from these artisans, right?
Exactly. It's trying to displace demand in a way that consumers, everyday consumers, without knowing, having to dive into what, you know, how the pig was raised, will be drawn to buying these great products that change the world. And you can, as a consumer, you can know you found a Good Food Award winning product because there's a little blue sticker. It's a little blue square that you'll find on charcuterie, beer, pickles, cheese, all throughout supermarkets in America.
Quick plug for the Newmans before we cut out.
Yep. So we're a family farming business. My wife, Kristen, my mom, Rita, we're all here. But so we run Newman Farm Heritage Berkshire Pork. We're located in South Central Missouri. We raise Berkshire pigs. Everything we raise is 100% pasture access. So we focus on meat quality and quality of life for the animals. And we've been very lucky to work with Heritage Foods and Patrick for many years. And we believe in good food raised right. That's what we do.
Good meat or no meat at all. The best meat or no meat at all. That's our new mantra.
I love it. All right. So thank you all for listening. Thank you to our guests. Thank you to Vitor. And stay tuned for Tech Bites up next.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening. Modern is smart and designed, black convertible top, and the gals don't mind. Sporting with me riding all around.